following is a rebroadcast of Studio Tulsa. This program first aired last year.
Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. It's said that 1 in 8 American women will develop breast cancer at some point in their lives. Of the 250,000 women in the U.S. that develop breast cancer in a given year, a quarter to a third of them will be diagnosed with a type known as triple-negative breast cancer, which means that the tumors are not driven by hormones like estrogen or progesterone. This means that more tailored treatments, which target the tumor and less so the rest of the body, won't work. Triple-negative breast cancer requires old, well-established, highly toxic chemotherapy agents, one of which is chemically mustard gas, used to deadly effect in World War I, and another with the nickname Red Devil, which can be so toxic to the heart that it can only be given in a limited total quantity over a whole lifetime. My guest today, Ann Boyer, has a new memoir called The Undying, in which she recounts her breast cancer diagnosis and treatment, all while a single mother of a teenager working as a teacher living paycheck to paycheck. Boyer is a poet and essayist, and she teaches philosophy, literature, and writing at the Kansas City Art Institute. She's the winner of the 2018 Cy Twombly Award for Poetry, and in 2018-19 was a Judith Wilson Fellow in Poetry at Cambridge University. Ann Boyer, author of the acclaimed memoir The Undying, is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Ann Boyer, welcome to Medical Monday. Let's start by having you just describe what the diagnosis was that you received 5 years ago.
Well, I was diagnosed with highly aggressive triple negative breast cancer, which is a type of breast cancer that has among the poorest prognosis of breast cancer subtypes because it doesn't depend on estrogen or progesterone to feed it. They can't do the targeted hormonal treatments of a lot of different types of breast cancer. And so the only treatment is chemotherapy and surgery. So it has a poor prognosis. I think one of the things that I should also say, though, is that in maybe the last 5 to 7 years, a great deal more research is being done about it. So hopefully we won't have such a poor prognosis in the near future.
So one of the things that intrigued me, if I interpreted this correctly, was that you were told after you had a biopsy of the lump that it was indeed breast cancer and it wasn't, you know, hormone sensitive. It, in fact, was this mm-hmm. triple negative that I think you heard from what your friend called Dr. Baby. I wanted to ask you about that, this baby-faced doctor who was giving you this kind of very dismal bit of news. But as you describe it, the tumor was so aggressive, this type, that it didn't set up infrastructure for itself. Like it did, and they wanted to do other biopsies and other parts of your body, but worried that it had spread. And you sort of said, you know what, let's just go right to treatment.
Yeah, well, so it was necrotic, which is kind of one of the things about triple negative is that there are subtypes of this subtype that are really aggressive, and I had that type. And it also seems that the younger the person who has the cancer, the more virulent and aggressive the cancer is. And so I just turned 41 when I was diagnosed and was, I thought, quite healthy, you know, like going to the gym and eating my kale and all that sort of stuff. And so it was almost as if the cancer's aggressiveness matched the kind of overall feeling of like vitality in my own body. And there were other problem areas that they wanted to biopsy to see if those two were cancer, but we'd already decided to do chemotherapy before surgery. And it didn't seem to me like that the treatment was going to change at all. I find biopsies to be really sort of painful and stressful events, and thought there was sort of no need to see what was going on inside, and that we already had enough knowledge that we were going to have to do this like this really aggressive chemotherapy right away. And, you know, I think that was probably the right decision, just in terms of having enough information to move forward, but not spending so much time looking for information that it puts the treatment off.
Yeah, well, you make a great point. It wasn't going to change the management in any way because you were still going to have these drastic treatments that were going to essentially wipe the slate clean. I think ideally speaking, it was going to wipe away any trace of cancer. But of course, we all know that it wipes away a lot of the good stuff too. But speaking of that, you were 41, so young mm-hmm. when you were diagnosed. And in your prologue in the book, The Undying, you mention you write about many women throughout literature who also suffered from very early breast cancer. And of course, one of the famous ones is Susan Sontag.
Yeah.
But I guess I wasn't really aware of Audre Lorde or Jackie Suzanne from the Hollywood days, the Valley of the author of The Valley of the Dolls. And so, I mean, you really did research just to figure out where you fit in sort of literary and breast cancer history.
Well, I think that's the first thing I did because I'm a writer and you know, because I also teach literature. And I think that the very first thing I did upon diagnosis was try to sort of position my cancer inside of a kind of literary history. My friends immediately started sending me books. So you get this kind of new library when you get cancer, if you're a reader, in which everyone who's had any kind of experience with it and has something that they should read. So all the books were coming in the mail from my friends, and I went to sort of understand the way that breast cancer had affected literature. And it is kind of shocking. It's like the number of writers who have had breast cancer in particular and who have written about it is like sort of astounding cast of literary history. All sorts of profoundly intelligent and talented women who've had to deal with it, some of whom survived past it, but some like Rachel Carson, who were really brought down by it right in the middle of their careers.
Yeah, so you say that she was diagnosed with breast cancer right in the process of writing Silent Spring, her most famous book, and then died very soon thereafter from the breast cancer. One thing I learned, too, is that Susan Sontag never put the words I and cancer in the same sentence.
Right. So illness as metaphor really intentionally seeks a kind of distancing from her own experience with cancer. And in her journals from around the same time, like, it's either redacted or the thinking about cancer is very sort of obscured and abstracted rather than personal. Rachel Carson was an even more kind of dramatic example of this. She was afraid that the reception of Silent Spring would be affected by her cancer diagnosis, that people would say that she had a personal vendetta against the chemicals and the corporate polluters of the environment. And so she worked hard to obscure her cancer, even as it went into her bones. I think that, if I'm remembering correctly, you know, she would, I think one of her bones broke. I hope I have this right. But that to sort of obscure this during public events in order to try to, like, have some kind of sort of seriousness or validity to what she was saying and not being linked to this personal diagnosis. So that those are really dramatic examples of the taboo around the personal story around breast cancer. And then there's this huge cultural shift around breast cancer narratives where suddenly it seems as if telling your story becomes a requirement of having cancer rather than a taboo around it.
Yeah, so we definitely live in a time where sharing is seen as paramount. And of course, it is empowering, definitely, for many to share their cancer journeys, you know, almost to the point I think you make and many others have made about maybe you want to be private about it, but there seems to be this advocacy type obligation to go public with what could be very personal.
Yeah, and part of that is just the way that we're taught we should go public with it. And so one of the things that was infuriating to me, and I think to so many other people I've talked to who are cancer survivors, particularly breast cancer survivors, is that we're supposed to tell our stories, but we're only supposed to tell certain parts. So the positive and brave struggle, right? Like the struggle of the person who survives and not the person who ultimately ends up dying of their disease. Those are the stories we're supposed to tell, and the other gets suppressed. To the point at which if we utter something negative, there's an immediate kind of social correction that we're going to make ourselves sicker if we say how much it sucks, right? If we say, you know, how scared we are or how angry or confused we are about what's happening to us. And so while there became this culture of sharing around cancer, the sharing was really selective and it was sort of immediately co-opted too by various kind of profitable interests around cancer culture. And in itself wasn't going to be enough, I think, as I had cancer. I had to figure out a way to write about my experiences where I didn't fall into certain kinds of traps about how to tell the story of Vino.
Well, you definitely told it in an incredibly unique way. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Ann Boyer. She's author of the new memoir, The Undying. And I'm going to read the subtitle because it's brilliant. Pain, Vulnerability, Mortality, Medicine, Art, Time, Dreams, Data, Exhaustion, Cancer, and Care. And Anne is a poet and essayist based in Kansas City, an award-winning poet. And I want to touch on something you mentioned earlier, is that once you were diagnosed, your friends sent you a library of literature about cancer, breast cancer, other kinds of cancer. But you also write quite humorously about the incredible number of health tips and health advice that you received, some which aligned with your worldview, some which was diametrically probably opposed to either your thought process or worldview. But I guess, how were you able to reconcile those pieces of advice, or at least those impulses, which probably come from a good place in most cases?
Oh, yeah. And I have to say that I understand every person who's ever had cancer who has gone straight for the baking soda cure or some other thing which seems totally implausible, right? It isn't research-based. I understand the fear that drives people into whatever direction they can find to look for hope. And I understand, too, that the available cancer treatments we have are totally inadequate for, like, quality survival, right, that they come at a cost. And so I never want to seem to make fun of the people who offer that help or who make those decisions themselves, because when you have cancer, sometimes you'll do anything, right, to survive, anything to avoid what is so terrifying. But yeah, I mean, you know, this chorus of contradictory information comes your way from the people who tell you you have to do everything your doctor tells you without question, or that you will, like, with certainty die, right? To the ones who tell you you should do nothing that the doctors tell you to do, that if only you drink carrot juice, you know, for 6 months and meditate for enough hours each day, you won't have cancer anymore. And in that distraught, distressed, panic state of cancer, trying to make sense of all of this information that floods in, all of these strong opinions, is, like, incredibly difficult. It's one of the things in the book where that feeling of doubt you're doing the right thing, at least for me, it's permeated everything about my treatment, is a state of not knowing what direction to look.
So I want to talk for a second about the treatment itself, because it is brutal. And because mm-hmm. you had this very aggressive type of breast cancer, the so-called triple negative breast cancer, you were subjected to a very old school, but well-known type of chemotherapy, which has an acronym, but two drugs in particular that you were given to poison the cancer. One is mm-hmm. cyclophosphamide, which was really used in World War I as mustard gas.
Yeah.
And the other is so-called Adriamycin, the red devil, as it's known, because it is a red yep. infusion. And you write very poetically, as is your style, about these drugs, both what they did to you, what they did for you, and kind of what they represent. You write in a way about one aspect of your care that I have not read in other accounts of people's treatment, cancer, memoirs, or even essays, which is that you thought about the consequences. For example, cyclophosphamide, 48 to 60 hours after you're given this infusion, you're not really supposed to be around anybody, and you are excreting into, you know, the wastewater system these poison metabolites. And so I guess we could start there.
Well, this is another one of these really confusing aspects of cancer, is that if you try to unravel the ethics around the cancer treatments we have now, the sort of overall social cost and environmental cost, there's no clear answer. And so I think I'm just the sort of person, the way that I cope with things is I do a lot of research. I want to know a lot of things, and I keep going deeper and deeper into whatever it is that I'm afraid of, as opposed to trying to ignore it. So perhaps I had, like, this, like, perverse appetite to know about the drugs that were being infused in my body, to wanting to understand them historically, to understand them medically, and to understand them in a kind of, like, set of social relations that make up our lives. And so all of this stuff, the stuff that comes from war, the development of chemotherapy, the way that we haven't moved past these really old-fashioned forms of chemotherapy, these kind of hyper-destructive remnants of the 20th century, and into a more gentle and, like, preservative form of treatment for cancer. Like, all of these things just sort of were swarming around me as the drugs would be infused into me. And that environmental cost is real. It's real, too. It's not just that one. Which one of the taxanes.
Right. Taxol from the yew tree, right?
Right, from an endangered tree. Like, I think the tree actually becomes endangered once the drug is developed. And so there's an environmental cost. And there's, of course, the irony that we know that at least some of our cancer comes from carcinogenic environmental triggers. And so this industrialized world intensifies or produces these cancers in ways we can't quite understand. And our treatment of the cancer also fits into the same system of destruction. I mean, it's not just that, the cost of the environment. So many cancer treatments are carcinogenic in themselves. And so you get exposed to your future cancer by treating your present cancer. It's this, it seems like a vicious closed circle of damage that you just get to temporarily evade and but never permanently find a way out of it.
You also wrote about not only the environmental cost, but the financial cost and somewhat of a little sense of perhaps guilt about that.
Well, right. And also it's just confusing. Like I was confused how it was that my cancer was more profitable than my work had ever been. That I've generated like more profit for someone through my cancer treatments than I had in all of my years working as a teacher and other kinds of jobs that I had. And so there's a kind of astounding like economic reality around cancer that I think I'm not smart enough to unravel. I tried to look at the numbers and I tried to see it from as many different points of view as I could. But of course there's like a guilt of the social and environmental cost. Whether it's a right guilt or a wrong guilt, I'll never know. I mean, I'm glad I survived, but I still have to think about the way that all of this operates in the larger picture.
Well, on that topic of finance, I mean, as you mentioned, you're a teacher and a writer, mm-hmm. and you're also a single mom, and you essentially work paycheck to paycheck, or it says in the biography about you.
Yeah, but, or I did at that time. Yeah, things are better now. But.
Good. Well, but you didn't have a lot of sick time accrued.
No.
And as a single mom, you didn't have really any adults in the household that could help you, so you really had to rely on friends to take you to and from appointments, friends who also had jobs who didn't have significant leave. And as you point out, the Family Medical Leave Act really only covers immediate family members. It doesn't cover your friends getting time off work to help their friend who has medical appointments or is getting chemotherapy. And so, you know, you painfully write about having just had chemotherapy, or maybe it was surgery, I guess, with drainage bags, you know, adhering to your chest, and without having only 10 days after this enormous surgery, and then giving what amounted to a 3-hour class, I think, about Walt Whitman's poetry. And I could not believe like that you had to do that.
Well, I still can't believe it either. But, you know, I used all of my FMLA and my sick time to have chemotherapy. Cancer doesn't obey the rules, right? So cancer doesn't fit into the neat categories of human resources policies or the federal government. Cancer probably, I mean, I think it's pretty fair to say somebody who had a cancer like mine probably should take a year off work or take a year to work part-time. The chemotherapy had taken so much out of me, and then I had some heart problems after the chemotherapy that, like, in between the surgeries that also took some time out. That by the time I had a double mastectomy, I didn't have time off anymore. I had this sort of patchwork. I have people substitute in my class, and I think I just did not want to lose my job, which is a source of pleasure and interest for me as well as a source of survival. I'd love to teach. So my friends just dropped me off while I was still in a daze from surgery, and I went in to teach. And I think that this is not uncommon. I think for people who don't have a big safety net in terms of their own savings, if they don't have partners who are there earning money to take care of them, I think for people who are in my situation, just working, even when you're really sick, even when you have something as serious as aggressive cancer, is pretty much the norm of survival. And it still isn't solved. So I had a biopsy for something else last week, and it was kind of under general anesthetic. And it was, again, the same situation where afterwards I'm waking up and the recovery nurse says, well, do you have someone to be with you for the next 24 hours? It's like, oh, no, we're back to this, right? Because I hadn't. But I didn't have that. But I was immediately being released from the hospital. And I think that there is a total lack of regard for the way that medicine and the kind of care that happens outside of the clinic and the hospital is structured, with the way that the lives of so many people are structured, especially single people, or people who maybe have family members who, for whatever reason, can't care for them, children who are too young, parents who are too old, partners who themselves are sick or disabled. And that, I mean, that of all the crises in the book, the one that caused me the most agony was the one of trying to solve this kind of social crisis of having cancer and being the wrong sort of person, as in the person who didn't have someone to take care of me during my illness, and having to scramble with my friends to make up for that.
And Anne, you talk about that social isolation, the medical and the financial costs, and yet the effort of writing this memoir, and you're an avid journaler, it sounds like, and you relied heavily on your journal because, of course, the chemotherapy affected your memory to some extent and your thinking, at least in the short term. But you call this an act of writing this book a reparative magic. And I see it in there. I think it's so important to, you talk about really the stress, but the trauma of going through this. So I guess we often encourage people to write out their thoughts. How did that process go?
Well, it took me years, and I would rather have written, in the book I say this quite a bit, that I would rather be writing about other things. And I think I made a sort of bargain with myself that if I lived, if the treatment was effective for me, that the thing I had to do was try to write a book telling the truth as I understood and saw it, and to make sure the book could get to as many people as possible. And so I had made that bargain, and I was really sorry about it because it took so much work. I was recovery from cancer was so much more difficult than I anticipated. I really imagined that I would just come back to myself after treatment. And I didn't understand about the lingering chronic pain and exhaustion, the cognitive damage, the damaged immune system. I didn't understand that that just lingers on for so many people and is really hard to overcome. And so I was writing this book, had made the pledge to write this book all during this difficult, rocky recovery, while still, of course, raising my daughter, going to work, doing all the things that a person does in their life. And it took quite a lot of time to do it. I mean, I think that what I wanted, right, is like that somehow out of the senselessness of having had the experience of cancer as I did, that I would be able to make something that could sort of rival in its art and in the truth it tells, like the kind of nonsense of cancer itself, that I would do something to pay back my survival in making the book. And so it seemed to take it much longer than I had anticipated it would. And I'm very glad it's done now. Like the when the book came out, I said, I don't have to have cancer anymore. Like it was finally, I think, like the last act of throwing it off is to see the book in the world.
Yeah, but such a physical, emotional, and symbolic act of doing so, and you know, hard to do, but so brilliantly rendered. You use the metaphor of the snake, and there's a evil appearing snake, at least on the cover of this hardcover edition. But talking about the snake molting its skin, how is the new you different from the previous version?
Well, I have to tell a story, though. The day that it was a week to the day that my book was officially released, a friend found a snake skin in my garden that is precisely the shape of the snake on the cover of the book. So absolutely creepy. And so I have it in a little shadow box now, right? But I'll have this snake skin forever. Well, this is like the most inexplicable and magic kind of omen for the book, that a snake decided that mine was the perfect garden in which to set its skin and move on in the world. And so, I mean, I think that anyone who's had cancer, serious illness or serious trauma knows that there's a part that does that evil work of comparison, like what I was before and what I am now. And sometimes it doesn't come out so favorably. Like sometimes I think, oh, I wish I had these things I had before. I wish I was that person before this happened to me. But like, I don't want to say that doesn't still exist for me. But there was this other thing that happened, I think, working through the book and working through recovery, connecting especially with other people who've had cancer or illness or been touched by it as a caregiver or in some other way, is that I made all of these new connections, all these like new memories and forms of life, experiences. And so while I do kind of miss who I was before, too, honestly, that there's this whole set of new stuff that came in to fill in those wounds that the cancer made.
Yeah, and you're brutally honest in assessing those wounds. There's a scene in the book where you and a friend are, you know, you're staring in the mirror counting literally the holes and the bruises that have been wrought to your body, not to mention the hair loss. And something that you talked about that I never read about anywhere was that the chemotherapy caused you to lose your nails too. And you said you can imagine that it, you know, losing your nails slowly is about the same as you imagined having them pulled off, that it's incredibly painful.
They lift off. It's that particular. I didn't want that to happen. I would go in and put ice packs on my nails in the hope, because I was like, well, I've been insulted enough. This is one thing. Just like, let me keep this one part of me. And of course, it didn't work. And so they do lift off. Mm. And it's remarkable to think how many people actually live through this. The number of people who go through chemotherapy, like the numbers in the millions, right? And who do lose all of these things we think of as ourselves, who lose hair, eyelashes, body parts to the process of cancer, and yet somehow still make it through.
So we've talked about the fact you're a single mom. You have a teenage daughter who is actually mm-hmm. still not a teenager, but is still a teenager. She was 14 at the time you were diagnosed.
Yeah.
And as part of your workup for breast cancer, you had the genetic test, the BRCA genetic testing, and came back negative. And so we're sort of, I imagine, probably pretty happy to tell your daughter, like, look, I have this mm-hmm. terrible thing, but it doesn't appear to be that I have this, you know, specified gene anyway that's going to cause it. So this is good news for you. And I was impressed and amazed at her insight. What was it she said?
Well, that the world that made me sick is still the world she has to live in.
Yeah.
And so it was a devastating observation, because I really was. I think I got that genetic test back and I was so happy for her, because the type of cancer I have is often linked to BRCA. And that was, and for her to make this like perfectly true observation about the carcinogens that exist in the world. I mean, I think for our children, the situation might even in some ways be worse, that they're living with a larger load of carcinogens in our environment that we don't have a remedy for, like we don't even really have accurate knowledge about. And so, yeah, that was hard. I tried in a lot of ways to keep her story out of the book, just because her story is her story and not mine to tell. But I think I gave her that moment so that like the book like landed lightly upon what her experience was like, or my experience being a mother still inside of cancer treatment.
Yeah. Well, it's incredibly poignant, the memoir, beautifully rendered. And I mean, so much poetry therein. I mean, written in verses almost, you know, these interesting paragraphs. And the name of the book is The Undying. It's a memoir by my guest today, Ann Boyer. Ann, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening.